simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift
podcast. Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr.
Yeah, hi.
And we got one of our favorite people back on the show, Dr. Nicola Guest. She's an RD, PhD, and researcher at Oxford. So fancy. And she just wrote a really cool review paper about the use of CGMs and those without type 2 diabetes and kind of the ramifications of such. They're the hot topic. We've talked about them before. And so we wanted to kind of go over it again. And her review article was awesome. So welcome back, Dr. Guest. Nicola, what do you want to go by?
Oh, Nicola. Or Nick, okay. If it's easy to pronounce.
All right. Nicola. Let's do this. So what was the reason you wrote this paper? You're active on Twitter a lot talking about this, but I'd love to get the gist.
Yeah. I mean, really, it came from my patients. Like, I've been aware that there were companies that were using CGM in people without diabetes, that it was something that was happening. And I was pretty neutral about it in the sense I thought, so what? People have more info, and didn't give it much thought until I started to get more and more patients through who were being really misled. They thought it meant, you know, the glycemic excursions meant something that they didn't. Mm-hmm. And very often I saw that people were making worse dietary choices because they were eating to the CGM. And that's when I started looking into it. And I think the problem as I saw it was not that people are misunderstanding themselves, but they're being told by companies selling these devices or by nutrition companies using these devices, control glucose spikes, that kind of thing. And I felt like, as a person with a background in diabetes and nutrition and diabetes, that I wanted to look into it and present some fair evidence for the public.
We love it. Yeah. We've done some podcasts on this. Why don't we go over, like, what do they mean by, like, glucose excursions versus spikes? And, like, what's the basics again, real quick, if we can?
I mean, I can... When
somebody eats some sugar, you see your glucose go up. CGMs...
We need to talk about what normal is and why we have these normal ranges, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, I guess I can do that as the endocrine guy. So,
you talked about this though, right? In your paper,
yeah,
you went over like what's normal. Like,
I mean, the bottom line is we don't know what normal is on a CGM.
Right.
Because we don't have data sets to tell us. But what we do have very strong data sets in tens of thousands of people, 10, 20 years follow-up data, is we know the relationship between different concentrations of glucose, whether by A1C, fasting glucose, or two-hour glucose, and their relationships to things like risk of future type 2 diabetes or cardiovascular disease. So, for example, and I think this is really important to emphasize to people who don't quite know what these values mean, that if you take something like a two-hour glucose value, what is that? That is taking someone's glucose 2 hours after you give them 75 grams of glucose. If it's still high, that's an indication of pre-diabetes or diabetes, and that happens because your pancreas is not working properly and you have insulin resistance. So the duration of glycemia is very long. Your glucose simply doesn't come down. And you really need to compare that to what people are talking about in terms of glucose spikes, which is just an acute rise and fall. So instead of glucose being high, maybe 2 hours afterwards, it might go high 30 minutes after a meal, but it comes back down pretty quickly. And it's that's normal.
Yeah. And what are those values? We went over this. Casey, Nicola, you can...
Shall I say millimol per liter? And then Carl can translate to milligram per deciliter?
I was like, oh,
that's
Lord.
Funny. Oh, that's actually really funny. America.
We're good. Because
pre-diabetes is 2 hour glucose of 7.8 millimoles per liter.
So that's... Oh, my God. So a two-hour post... glucose tolerance test diagnostic for any type of diabetes, by the way, type 2, type 1, or other more rare types, is a 200 milligrams per deciliter after a 75 glucose load.
And I think pre-diabetes is 140. So I think 7.8 is equivalent to 140.
And below that is normal. And impaired fasting glucose, so a fasting sugar above 100 milligrams per deciliter is pre-diabetes. Above 120 or 126 and above is consistent with diabetes. And, you know, you mentioned, why do we even have these diagnostic criteria? Because they are what have correlated with all those data you just talked about to not just like other, you know, like cardiovascular disease, but the microvascular complications of hyperglycemia. So yeah. Retinopathy is kind of the big one that was shown all those way back long before we had continuous glucose monitors, when people were checking blood sugar multiple times a day. And to be honest, the history of glycemic monitoring is not that old. You know, if you talk to my mentors before we were even all around, they were barely being able to do anything for these people with type 2 or type 1 diabetes, let alone, you know, kind of figuring out the type 2 diabetes stuff. They were doing, you know, urine tests, just shooting up insulin, not really knowing what they were. I mean, even just simple glucose monitors have come a long way in the past, you know, 50 years.
And I think there's something really important to add as well about that fasting glucose cutoff and where that came from. Because lots of people have this tendency to think, oh my God, if my glucose ever gets above 7 or 126, either 7 or 126, if it ever gets above that, that's diabetes and that's bad. But actually, if you look at, I think it was the 96-97 ADA statement on diagnosis of diabetes, the 7 came about because that was so closely correlated with 11.1. So because very often they would just do a fasting glucose test for people, you needed a value of fasting glucose that would tell doctors the likelihood of people having a 2-hour glucose above 11.1, and that's what they found. So it's not that 7 is the danger zone. It's that if you ever or if you have a fasting glucose that's 7, there's a really good chance your 2-hour glucose is super high. And all that means is that you are exposed to very high glucose for probably 24 hours a day. And I think that's, again, really important to get across, because it's the prolonged exposure to hyperglycemia that defines both pre-diabetes and diabetes. It's not some acute 20-minute, you know, exposure above, say, 140, for example.
Right.
So, yeah, so this is where the low carbers and other people who really push the CGMs and low carb in general will say, like, hey, your blood sugars were up above 140. They'll always say 140 because that's kind of what's the number in England? I don't know. Whatever. 140.
You're going to need subtitles. You're going to need subtitles. I'm serious.
140 milligrams per deciliter. That's our the pre-diabetes cutoff for a
2-hour glucose tolerance.
For a 2-hour glucose tolerance. But on a CGM, what they'll say is that, hey, it spiked above that for a little bit, and then, you know, and then after, you know, a couple hours, it's back down to the normal range. But what they'll say is that above that range is damaging for that time. Any spike above there, and you just didn't know it was happening because you never measured it. And I think you looked at the data. They have no data for that. Right.
Because Nicola, you did the paper. We have data for people with diabetes and multiple finger sticks throughout the day, which we had to do before continuous glucose monitoring. And now we have the continuous glucose monitors that are pretty darn good. They're imperfect, mind you, but we have the data that correlate to these goals we have for people with diabetes in a glucose-centric manner, mind you, just the glycemia. That's why we have those goals, because they predict adverse outcomes.
So Nicola, you wrote the paper on this. I know that you had to address that. I don't know if I read it quickly, but I know that's what people are saying. If you spike above there, even for a little bit of time, it's damaging to your endothelial lining, your glycocalyx, all these things.
We have no data. And I think several things are important to note here is we should speak reflective of the amount of certainty we have about things. And the fact is we have no data of what happens if your fasting glucose is normal and it comes down quite quickly, but you happen to have really high peaks. Because we've never had CGMs, we don't have long prospective data, and we will get that. So we don't know that for sure, but we do have some idea of what glucose looks like in healthy people. So when I say healthy, I mean people with a healthy, what we call healthy A1C. And probably that's an A1C that's under definitely 5.7, maybe a bit lower than that. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the data. But I think if you said an A1C under 5.4, most people would be very happy with that and say that's not associated with future risk of CVD and other things. So what you can do is you can take people with an A1C of, say, 5.4, give them CGMs and see day to day what does their glycemia look like. And the data's slightly conflicting because different devices, we know, different CGM devices have different levels of accuracy. Lots of things affect their readings, blah, blah, blah. There's also a really important point that whenever anyone is taking part in a study, they're probably going to eat better and behave, you know, live more healthy lives because they know they're being watched. But that data basically shows, yeah, most people never go above 7.8. Very often, though, there are peaks to, let's say, 11.1, and there or thereabouts. So I think that can give you some...
And that's 200 for us, 200 milligrams.
Thank you for the translation. So I think you can... say with some degree of confidence, if you get occasional glucose excursions up to 11 and it comes down quickly, it's probably not anything to worry about. Yeah. But we don't have, we can't be completely certain about that. And hopefully, as we get one of the advantages of more people wearing these and we get prospective data sets is we might get some idea. But yeah. The other thing I really want to address, because you do hear this claim by people basically saying, oh, you've got to reduce glucose peaks because they're going to cause endothelial damage. And you'll see the glucose goddess does this, and she quotes studies. And there's a really well-conducted study which infused glucose into people to basically experimentally expose them to 5 millimoles per liter, which is 90 milligram per deciliter, for 6 hours. Then it raised the glucose to give them 270 milligram per deciliter. So super low and super high. And each time they were exposed to that concentration, it was for 6 hours. So 6 hours at 90, 6 hours, at, I think 270, 6 hours at 90. And what they found is that glycemic variability was worse than just being at 270 continuously. And so this was really strong experimental data that even controlling for the concentration, having marked glycemic variability is worse for you.
But so it was worse in what way, though?
Absolutely. Because, you know, the concentration counts. So most people, everyone with normal NGT based on an OGT, sorry, normal glucose tolerance. Shall I say that again? Are you going to edit this?
No, we're not editing this. We publish this as is. So anybody listening that's going,
I love it, because this would be really good edit. This is fun. Okay, let me start that again. So no one with normal glucose tolerance defined by A1C or GTT ever reaches 270, I would bet. They certainly don't for 6 hours. Right. So those data have nothing to do with acute glucose spikes.
But what were they looking at as their bad?
Was the harm?
You say it was bad. Yeah. What was the harm that they saw?
The outcome, it was some measure of, they were looking at inflammatory factors, and I think they were looking at some measure of vascular function.
Oh, okay, like a brachial.
That's the endothelial function stuff that they get into.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we do the study that I always cite, the biggest one we have in for CGM with healthy people was just published a couple of years ago in Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism with 150 people who don't have any type of dysglycemia. So no diabetes, no prediabetes. They range from 7 to 80 years old.
They defined that by, they didn't have diabetes or prediabetes defined by A1C or GTT, right?
And you're right, and fasting glucose. None of the real diagnostic criteria that we know are correlated these things. And they included, you know, ages 7 through 80, and they wore a Dexcom G6. So the G6 is now just becoming obsolete because the G7's out now, so which is a little bit more accurate. But basically, their average glucose for the whole time was like 98 to 99 milligrams per deciliter, or 5.4 to 5.5 millimoles per liter for you. And only those over 60 had a little bit higher at 104. And And then the other thing we look at is the time and range. So when I look at time and range for people with diabetes, we look at how much time they spend between 70 milligrams per deciliter and 180. And our goal is 70%, because that correlates to all the outcome measures that we know are beneficial, like an A1C under 7 or 6.5 and all these other things. And so these people were not only between 70 and 180, but 70 to 140 milligrams per deciliter, mind you, 96% of the time. And they had very minimal variability, meaning they didn't go all over the place randomly. They had very tight consistency, if that makes any sense. And I mean, they only 2% of the time were they ever over 140 milligrams per deciliter. And that's just normal time for, can't remember how long they did it for, but, you know, for like 2 weeks, 10 days.
So
those are normal. Those are normal levels that we're talking about to compare things to.
I think it's important to note, though, whenever you're talking about 1% or 2%, because it always sounds really like a tiny amount of time. But if you take into account that a CGM will take 288 readings a day, because that's every 5 minutes, 2% of them is about 5 readings. So that's about 25 minutes. So when you say 2%, you're basically saying 25 minutes a day, mm-hmm. in these healthy people, their glucose is above that concentration.
Yeah.
So again, it shows you, yes, the majority of time people are within a certain range, but some
there's a little bit normal. Over. Yeah. Because it's going to happen. Like, yeah. And sure, some things will do it more than others. But.
And we have, and as Nicola would say, we have zero data to show that this is harmful.
Yeah, and I would just almost take this even further and say, we do have data on CGM-derived metrics for glycemic variability. We now have much larger data sets, and we have those people followed over time. And it's really striking to me that even in type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and even insulin control type 2 diabetes, there is even a question of how much these measures of glycemic variability influence outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so particularly in type 1, there was a consensus statement about the use of CGM and what metrics should matter that was published. And basically they said CGMs and the data from them tell us that they're really useful for preventing hypoglycemic episodes. And glycemic variability was tightly related to hypoglycemic episodes. So in other words, you cannot tell from those data whether you are reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease because you're reducing hypos, or because you're reducing variability because they're tightly controlled. But what is interesting is that many of the parameters from a CGM are related to CVD in type 2 diabetes and not type 1. So that tells you, that indicates to me, this is not about glycemia. Because if it were about glycemia, you would see glycemic variability per se related to outcomes. So what's the difference between type 1 and type 2? Is that in type 2, you have this underlying metabolic dysfunction, this lipid dysfunction that is causing type 2 diabetes. So it's very probably that it's the underlying pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes that is related to these poor outcomes and is also causing glycemic variability.
So
it's not the glycemic variability causing CVD.
Well, right. I'll go farther and just say in these huge, long studies of type 1 diabetes we have, looking at before we had continuous glucose monitoring that we kind of get these data from leading up to continuous glucose monitors, is it took a long time to show, cardiovascular benefit from improved glycemic control. So to your point, a glucose-centric approach isn't really great for cardiovascular disease. That's why all those diagnostic levels are about microvascular disease, retinopathy, neuropathy, nephropathy, kidney stuff, as opposed to the cardiovascular risk, which is the type 2 diabetes. It's a whole cardiometabolic dysfunction syndrome. That's why there's right. a whole different level of cardiovascular risk. There is increased cardiovascular risk in type 1 diabetes, don't get me wrong, and we need to treat them, and there is that risk, but the glycemic control, that it took a long time to show the cardiovascular benefit for glycemic from glycemic control.
I'm glad you segued into this, because I was going to say basically what I see is that they're missing the forest for the trees, because we want to treat the underlying pathophysiology, which adiposity, whatever you want to call it, which is the underlying inflammatory milieu. We can start using big fancy words, whatever. But essentially, when they're saying to lower their glycemic excursions or glucose spikes and cut out carbs, what we really want to do is lower their adiposity, lower their body fat, which would then have the benefit of, or hopefully the benefit of what we want to prevent.
If that's all they're talking about, if they're talking about like cardiovascular health stuff.
It's everything, right? Yeah.
You know, and because there are other dietary quality methods without even losing weight that have cardiovascular benefit that don't necessarily, you know, have anything to do with glycemic excursions or you know, the old glycemic index stuff, which has never really been shown to.
Your understanding of what the opposing view is that glucose spikes are damaging, and that we should minimize our glucose spikes by adopting a lower carbohydrate type of diet and changing our diet based upon that data. Is that, am I getting that right? That's my understanding. But
so that your question is that what other people are saying?
Yeah, because we want to make a steel man.
Why is Peter Attia taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from Dexcom to tell everyone to wear a CGM when they don't need it? That's what I want to know. What is he trying to, why, where's he getting that from? Because I'm just trying to get it for my patients with diabetes. And it's very helpful. And we do. And it's very helpful for those with diabetes. And we have outcome data to show it. And individuals will tell you it's beneficial. We can use professional blinded CGMs to you know, if we don't trust the A1C and we want to see what's really going on with people. I just, you know, had one today where we were able to take her off some medicine because her CGM was so great. She has type 2 diabetes, though. Why does Peter Attia think the three of us and other people without any disease of dysglycemia should wear a continuous glucose monitor? Because I can't figure it out, but you know.
I mean, we can laugh and say it's because he's taken hundreds of thousands of pounds from Dexcom. I think, you know, I really feel like people who've got a strong applied clinical background, and I'm sorry to say, people like Peter Ritty, I don't think they're, I don't want to say proper doctors. God, people are going to hate me for this. I imagine he does a kind of wellness clinic. So these are people who are in the top 0.5% of health anyway, and they want to take it a bit further. And my approach would be relax and enjoy your life and don't worry about anything. And I think actually you'd be healthier if you did that. But more seriously, I just think they've read a very narrow part of the literature. And have taken it to extremes. I mean, it's this idea, and you know, I get why people think it. Well, if really high glucose is bad, surely I want to keep it as low as possible. Yeah. And that's, I guess, reasonable. But the point to understand is there are always trade-offs, or very often there are trade-offs. I mean, certain things that might lower glucose that are very beneficial, physical activity, great. But many of the decisions people will be making to lower their glucose. Let me just finish my point, Carla. No, I can see you trying to talk.
Don't talk over our guest.
But many of the things that people will do to reduce their glucose could increase their cardiovascular risk in other ways. And we come back to the point you were making, Spence. Like, why do we, in type 2 diabetes, why do we care about it? And what do we want to manage? It's microvascular complications and cardiovascular disease. And you manage the patient with respect to all of that, blood pressure, lipids, etc. But we do know that glycemia reaches a concentration in diabetes that is harmful. So absolutely, we should pay attention to it. The wild thing to me is in people where the evidence we have right now overwhelmingly says their glucose is not causing a concern. But then you have at least half the population, I'm sure it's the same in the US, have hypertension. And probably around 20% or a third, depending on how you define it, have lipids that are in a range that are harming their health. And people are focusing on this glucose. To me, it's because you can measure it. There are wearables for glucose. So people are narrowly focusing on that in a bid to control something that doesn't need worrying about or controlling.
So I guess I was going to ask you, what are the harms of this? Because that's what they claim. They go, well, what's the harm in having more information? So what are the harms?
Let's hear it.
I mean, I accept that I've seen lots of patients who I think have either made some unfortunate dietary choices based on believing they need to keep their glucose low. And also anxiety is another one. I appreciate it's a biased sample, because if they were doing really well and having a great time, they wouldn't come and see me. But I do think the risks, I mean, the first one, let's just start with quality of life and worry. Like, if people don't care and don't worry about it, great. But we all have enough to worry about in our lives, whether it's paying the mortgage, getting to work on time, like whatever it might be. The idea that you would pay attention to something that you absolutely don't need to pay attention to me, it just seems like a pretty bad idea health-wise. And let me compare it to something else, because I bet this is coming. You know how people think about inflammation being a bad thing and it's associated with heat, blah, blah, blah. You know that someone's going to come along and say, oh, you know how you get hot after you eat a meal, like the thermogenic effect of food? That's inflammation. So what you need to do is record your temperature after you eat and aim to keep it as low as possible. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. People are just taking these very, very narrow measures of health and applying them to very normal situations and almost pathologizing normal physiology. And that's what I think these people are doing. So in terms of the, based on the data we have right now, for most people, I don't think CGMs are going to be useful. Let's talk about that a bit more in a second, but you asked me what the harms were. So anxiety and just worrying about it just pointlessly is one. Two is many people stop eating things that are going to lower their blood pressure because they cause a glucose rise. I see that a lot. The biggest clinical outcome I see, though, from CGM use is a rise in cholesterol, or LDL cholesterol.
And how convenient. Because
people are eating lower carb and they're eating higher fat.
How convenient if you're a low carber and you just are skeptical or even deny the ability of the LDL particles to penetrate and cause atherosclerosis.
Well, you know what? And it's not just healthy people, by the way. So when we talk about people with type 2 diabetes specifically, and we try to get them into remission, however we want to define that, basically normal, you know, A1C without medications and that sort of thing. You know, the low carb zealots, evangelicals out there also use CGM data to suggest, hey, that's why type 2 diabetes patients need to go extremely low carb, high fat. And so I always, you know, I think we need to do a better job of articulating that this glucose-centric definition of remission. Yeah, we can. Yeah, absolutely. I have type 2 diabetes patients who make their sugars like really, really, really good, you know, cutting their carbs, which we can cut carbs in a healthy way, mind you, by the way. But there's other aspects to the pathophysiology, especially the cardiovascular risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome. So yeah, if they start going low carb, high saturated fat, because that's what the keto evangelicals said to do, but their CGM looks great. Well, now they're not in remission. They still have the disease process of their cardiovascular risk.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's worth mentioning, like in the big remission trial, the direct one, people came off their antihypertensives because their blood pressure went into the normal range. They lost a ton of weight. All of the validated CVD risk scores came down massively. But the question still remains, what effect does being in remission for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years have on lifetime CVD risk? We don't know. I mean, I think with regard to low carb, if people want to do it to the extent possible, unsaturated fats over saturated, and even if they do have saturated fat, but it doesn't raise the LDL cholesterol, I mean, great,
yeah,
fantastic, because most of them will lose weight.
Yeah.
But again, it comes back to, should we only be paying attention to glucose? No, of course not. All of the other things, blood pressure and lipids, vascular function, etc., matter just as much.
I think the anxiety thing that you bring up is the biggest issue when all these people argue with us online. I mean,
I've worn every,
because endocrinologists in training, we always wear the CGMs. We got to learn what the heck we're doing, right? So we wear them. And it's still, every time I try a new one on, it still gives me anxiety.
Yeah, it gives me anxiety.
They're also
too.
Not perfect, right? I mean, they are not absolutely accurate. They're better, right? This thing called the MARD, it's now into the single digits, which means they're pretty close to, you know, they're correlating lab sugars, but they're not perfect. And yeah, there's no reason to give yourself anxiety about it because it doesn't actually matter if you don't have disease, from what we can tell.
I mean, I think it would be really useful to have, I mean, I know this is an obvious statement, to actually have data about what profiles look like in relation to what disease. So to be able to have 10 years of CGM profiles in people with normal glucose tolerance and see, because it would provide reassurance. I would expect that, and I think what we'll see is that glucose excursions can go higher than we think they should. And actually, as long as your overall A1C or your glucose is low most of the time, it has absolutely no difference whatsoever. That's what I think we'll see. And I think it would be nice to have that data to be able to provide reassurance for people.
Yeah, and I think we will.
Well, but think about a normal oral glucose tolerance test. It's 75 grams of glucose by itself.
Yeah, straight,
no fat, fiber,
syrup.
Anything else. So think about when you eat a meal, a big meal, you go out for pizza and you have some dessert afterwards and you drink a soda, whatever.
You're also getting blood lipid through the roof.
Yeah, you have a hyperlipemia, whatever. Yeah, but what I saw in my glucose monitor, and then I even got a new one because the rep said mine must have been faulty. I mean, like, it did. Like, I went up to like maybe 160 or something like that. It was, I ate a high load of carbohydrate and fat. And so, but my A1C is 4.9%. I just got
to
check.
It came back down immediately, though. See, your body functions. You have good
insulin
sensitivity.
Well, no, it stayed up a little for like 30 minutes, as Nicole was saying.
But it came back down. That's what she's.
It comes back down. Yeah, but that's what people, that's the thing. It was kind of like, what is this? Is this okay?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody knows. But again, my A1C is 4.9. I have all other markers of very good insulin sensitivity.
If you did that all the time, maybe that wouldn't be great.
First of all, but my adiposity, if I did that all the time, my adiposity wouldn't be what it is right now, which is the underlying cause of all this disease, is what I think, not the actual glucose excursion.
I'm even worse than that, Spence. So I have a habit sometimes of being a night owl. And sometimes I'll eat in the middle of the night. And one time, the only time I've ever worn a Dexcom, it was for preparing for a study we were doing in night shift workers with diabetes. So I wore it and I went out for a run at like 2 o'clock in the morning because I was writing a grant. I ate an entire pizza. I mean, the pizza probably had like 160 grams of carb in it. And mine went up to 12, which is about 215 milligrams per liter.
That's
went
impressive.
Up, came back down 2 o'clock in the morning. And my A1C is 5.
It was also
there you
while
go.
You're so here's, and just for context for people. So I do a lot of 2-hour glucose tolerance tests to screen people who have a very high risk of prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, right? So I'm literally looking at people who have significant abdominal obesity. They usually have known insulin resistance because of their dyslipidemia. Maybe they already have some prediabetes, and I'm trying to see if they have type 2 diabetes, because I need to know if they have it for a variety of reasons, because it dictates how aggressive we are and everything like that in monitoring. And I am telling you, it is so uncommon for the patients that I have that I'm screening fairly early on in the disease process to get type 2 diabetes criteria. We check them multiple times a day, and we're not finding that many new diagnoses. Now, obviously, if we did that to everyone at risk, that's why we have a lot of people with type 2 diabetes, they'd have it, but we're treating them and they have disease. So for a normal person with normal glycemic health to spike up that high at two hours, mind you, it doesn't happen. And there's a reason we have those criteria, going back to what you said, they're correlated to the complications of hyperglycemia from diabetes.
Okay. Here's what they'll also say. We have blood you mentioned this, but I see them tweet this out. We have blood pressure monitors. We have thermometers. We have all these other measures, and nobody ever says anything about them. Why are people mad that we have CGMs? And I think you already kind of said this, but like, why don't we get mad at those other things? I mean, I have my answer, but I'd be interested to hear what you'd have to say.
I mean, apart from ambulatory blood pressures that people use in clinic, like if you worry about someone, if they've got white coat syndrome, you'd give one to take home. People aren't wearing them 24 hours a day. I think that's a key difference. Another one is what people are being told this stuff means. And I think that's a huge part of the problem too, is that there is a real fear around diabetes. And again, it's like we talked about, you know, if diabetes is a high blood sugar and that's bad, surely I want to keep mine as low as possible. And because people aren't used to ever seeing a glucose rise, when they see it on the profile that's printed out, it might look terrifying. It's like, oh my God, look how high my blood glucose is going, because we haven't educated people on what normal looks like. And at the same time, they're being told by companies like Levels, you know, who have these pictures on their website of a glucose excursion that goes up to, from memory, it's like 105, like the peak is 105 milligram per deciliter, and they've colored it red.
Yeah.
Like as in, oh my God, this is the great thing about CGM, because it can identify whether your peak is 105 and then you can go for a walk. And it's like, hey, listen, if you've eaten lunch and you want to go for a walk because you want to get some fresh air, go for it. But the idea that you're pathologizing something normal and freaking people out about, oh my God, my glucose is rising, I've got to do something, you're just going to cause immense anxiety.
Don't you shut your mouth.
You don't want to know what other healthy habit makes your glucose rise?
All right, that's fine. No, I forgot what I was going to say. Go ahead, you jerk.
All right, intensive exercise. What does it do to your glycemia and CGM?
Yeah, I've heard people say, I'm not exercising anymore because I saw a spike. And people, like, there's an Oxford Harvard medical student that said, No one ever said that. I'm like, what do you mean? I have a text message from a patient that was all upset that she was watching this, and then she was doing intense exercise, so she stopped doing high intensity exercise. I'm like, I don't know.
It's absolutely normal for high intensity exercise to increase glycemia, which would be seen on a CGM. Oh, and by the way, it also increases cortisol normally, because that's what it does. And so the guys out there telling people not to do intensive exercise because it increases cortisol and glycemia,
oh yeah, that too,
are going absolutely against all the data, because all the data pretty much show high intensity exercise is good for you.
Okay. I remember what I was going to say. What about the potential benefit? We shit on these things mm-hmm. all day long, but I could foresee that, hey, people that are eating pizza, eating brownies, and seeing these obviously increased glucose excursions versus if they were to eat lentils or whatever, just mm-hmm. put it, and just, and what if there are a way to coach them to go like, okay, you see in real time, these probably are having a negative effect, like not just like little 120, 130 from eating blueberries or whatever, but like bigger excursions. Like you said, you ate a pizza. It's like, for us, we know like, yeah, that's what happened. That's ridiculous. We don't eat it that much. But what if it could show those who have those habits to go like, hey, probably not a good idea. Is it possible that it could be beneficial?
I mean, I think this is a really good point, and I'm glad we touched on this. So I think it's important to emphasize, like, we are talking about negative impact from anecdotal data. So, yeah. And that's just because, like I said, I've seen it in my clinic. Anxiety can be a result, and high blood pressure or high cholesterol. So those can be the things that can happen anecdotally. But likewise, you cannot deny the anecdotes, for example, on Twitter, where people are saying, for me, it's really helped me consume a healthier diet.
Yeah.
And maybe that this would be helpful. And I think as a behavior change tool, this is where it could be useful. So yeah. For example, like, weight is always a hard goal, in the sense that people's weight loss goal is going to be 12 months into the future, you know, and it may be you weigh yourself once a week. So you get positive feedback once a week. Whereas potentially, if you have a goal on a CGM, like, you know, after every meal, my goal is to keep it limited to 140. And I'm going to do that by making sure I have lentils rather than, you know, white rice, whatever it might be. And I'm going to try to consume more fiber and healthier foods and keep my portion sizes of carbohydrates low. This is going to be my short-term biofeedback to tell me I've done the right thing. Yeah. Like, I can see that working.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of it.
It's been tested. It has. I mean, these have been tested for these exact ways. My mentor in endocrine fellowship.
People without diabetes?
Not with pre-diabetes though. And there's some, it was very hard to tell, but at least those with pre-diabetes have some sort of dysglycemic, you know, excursions. So it's a little bit easier to tell and make those changes. But even one of the studies done by my fellowship department at Walter Reed, it ended up not really showing anything because it didn't come with very good education. So the thought was, well, if you match it up with education, it's going to have potentially some better benefits. So that goes to what your point is, that, you know, you can make better choices, especially if you have some disease. If you don't have much disease, though, it's hard to see those things. You got to eat a whole pizza like you did to show the obvious issues. Whereas people with prediabetes at least kind of show some pathology in their CGM report. And with education, they can make some better choices. But if they just go by a keto evangelical, then they just might eat, you know, deep fried burger with no carbs in it and think that's better than the fruit that made their sugar go up to 145.
I think this kind of gets into any type of clinical testing, having pretest probabilities and understanding what you're going to do with the data, having proper coaching and management with that as well.
And also, and I think we need to be fair about what trials show, even with the available data in the future, that there's no one diet or, you know, lifestyle that works for everyone. And so, you know, because it's kind of like saying, well, plant-based doesn't work, exercise doesn't work, blah, 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 because in trials on average, you don't see much of an effect. But there will be, within those groups, individuals who do respond well to this type of intervention. And it's very possible that people who enjoy seeing this kind of data will respond positively and find it useful. So I think it's important to be open-minded at the same time as being skeptical. I think let's go back to your point about pre-diabetes, Carl. It's like we have good data on what prevents type 2. Sadly, and obviously, it's weight loss and exercise and probably a slightly healthier, high fiber, unprocessed diet. Like, we know those things. Would wearing a CGM give you any more information about what you should be doing? Like, no. Could it help people stick to the things that we know help? Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
So then, you know, the one other thing, speaking of Dr. Vigursky, who did a lot of these trials back, you know, before I started fellowship, I asked him about this last year, I think. And he's very skeptical and he's very evidence-based. And he said, well, you know, some of the, because the one thing we haven't talked about are athletes. And, you know, we were all athletes once, still try to pretend to be athletes. He said, well, you know, we'll see if people can correlate how they feel and perform to their glycemia based upon CGM data. So that's a long ways off. I think we have zero data, as far as I know, to suggest there's any benefit to it. But maybe somehow people will be able to figure out, oh, I do better, feel better, perform better when I'm in this situation glycemically. I don't know. That's an interesting thought.
I think there's more data in endurance activities. And I think, like, this comes down to the performance of the CGM. So carbohydrate availability or glucose availability for endurance exercises is the key thing you want to maintain. You need to have enough glucose in the bloodstream, whether it's exogenous or endogenous, to support endurance exercise. And potentially, CGMs could help people make sure they are dosing sufficiently during, say, let's say, 3-hour cycle ride. You know, if it starts dipping, start taking your gel. But the challenges with the CGMs at the moment is how they are affected by heat, sweat, movement, all of those things. And in particular, they become less accurate at times of rapid glucose change. Those kind of readings become difficult. But I could see that being a useful application for CGMs in athletes. So the second point is, and I say this because I've seen some not professional, not semi-professional, but just very, very fit people that do like 2 hours of hardcore cycling a day, particularly females who aren't eating enough. So they're not fueling properly. And what we've seen very often on CGMs is it dipping overnight or staying low. Overnight and into the morning. And they were not performing as well as they thought they could. So just by making sure they ate some more, you could help that. And Louise Burke has also written about this. So she's an amazing sports dietitian. And she's kind of said, you know, theoretically, it could help people recognize before weight is lost that they are under fueling. And this is probably important for professional athletes or very serious athletes who simply cannot have a day or two of not performing at their best. So rather than waiting till day 5 you know, in your training regimen and you've lost 1.52 kilograms, so you know you're in an energy deficit, a CGM could alert you sooner to the fact that you're in an energy deficit. So again, potentially a use there.
I love it. I don't know. I think we covered pretty much everything. Any other closing thoughts? I think the gist is like, hey, like if you don't have pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, like use at your own risk, understand the risk. Like if you want to just look at the data, have someone that's knowledgeable about this to talk you off the ledge. If you have a glucose excursion that goes up to 200 or even higher after eating a pan of brownies and pizza. I think that's the gist, but
yeah. What are your conclusions in your paper?
The title speaks for itself. It's just an evidence-free zone.
Yeah,
that we don't have any evidence.
That's good.
You know, we have indirect evidence, and I think we've described that it is very, very unlikely that a person with normal glucose tolerance, defined by A1C or a GTT, has anything to worry about with regard to glycemic excursions. And I really think the absolute key point is the profound difference between a chronically elevated, prolonged glycemic excursion and acute, brief, transient rises in glucose. Huge difference.
Yep, I love it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is fun. You two are funny.
And great paper. You know, that I think that's helpful.
Yeah.
I need to
have that as a reference just to please go read this.
I mean, it's not very sciencey, and I wrote it because practical diabetes, I don't think it's even like PubMedical, but it goes out to like practice nurses, GPs, people who will fall for Tim Spector's nonsense, you know, all this stuff. Yeah. And it's just like, guys, there's nothing here. There's no evidence that we have. So
smoke and mirrors. All right. Thanks so much for coming on. We're going to have you on again. I love it. The banter is great. Find Dr. Guess on Twitter. I think just Dr. Guess, and then Instagram as well. Anywhere else?
That's it.
Perfect. Here's our outro. Share this. Share this with anybody looking into CGMs for, you know, whatever nonsense they're thinking about. Yeah. Without disease.